It is our great pleasure to continue in the study of the book of Genesis at this time. We're now ready to begin at the 28th verse of the first chapter of Genesis. We're still in the sixth day of creation. The earth has now been perfectly formed. The water and the seas is in place. The atmosphere is in place. The water above the atmosphere, the canopy composed of mist, is now surrounding the earth. All the land is separated from the water. We have the vegetation has been created and is living. We have the animals in the sea, the animals in the air, and the animals on the land all created. And man and woman have been created. And so all that remains now is for God to give them the blessing, to give them the commission, and some instructions. So begin with verses 28 through 30, let's read. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, Behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of a tree, yielding seed, and to you it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. Having created man and woman, God pronounced a blessing on them. He gave them their basic instructions and commission. We are not told whether he created more than one pair of each animal kind. There could have been many pairs of each kind made, but only one man and one woman were made. This fact is made clear in Genesis 2 when the details of the formation of Adam and Eve are given. The first command given to this first man and woman was to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. The word replenish is translated as fill in the NIV version. The Hebrew for this word is male, M-A-L-E, and does not suggest the idea of refilling. It simply means to fill, fulfill, or to be filled. Of the approximately 300 times this word is found in the Old Testament, King James Version translates it replenish only 7 times, and in these 7 places, it could just as well have been translated as fill. This translation by King James is certainly no proof for the gap theory. The command was to fill the earth. Man has not yet filled the earth in accordance with God's command. Nevertheless, many people today are unduly alarmed over the so-called population explosion. Many are urging government controls in several ways to slow down population growth. We can feel confident that God's command, which he repeated after the flood, was made in full knowledge of the earth's ability to support a large population. This command has never been removed. Even at the present state of man's knowledge, the earth could support a much larger population than it now holds. It seems to be apparent that the earth's population could not continue to grow indefinitely without limit, but God no doubt has made adequate provision for such an eventuality. The scriptures tell us that the earth will be destroyed at the second coming of Christ. 2 Peter 3, verses 10 through 13, But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also, and the works that are therein, shall be burned up. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. This knowledge that he is coming again should be more of a concern to us humans than any danger of overpopulation. Also, some scientists claim that there is quite a bit of evidence in the studies of animal populations that when a given group increases in numbers to the optimum number for its own environmental limits, the population stabilizes. Not because of a struggle for existence, conflict, but by virtue of built-in physiological or psychological mechanisms which somehow slow down the reproductive activity of the population. And it is certainly possible that God would do the same with the human population. And we have no way of knowing the plans or abilities of God had man not failed his probation period in Eden. We can only speculate about what God would do if the earth were to be filled with the optimum level of human population, since our present decaying planet has never reached that level. This command to be fruitful and multiply and to fill the earth was given to be done only within the framework of monogamous marriage. We shall see that God makes this very plain in Genesis, the second chapter. God also instructed man to subdue the earth and have dominion over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. God is commanding man to conquer and then rule. But there is no actual conflict suggested, since everything God made was pronounced as good. This command to subdue and have dominion is actually commissioning man to study the earth with all of its intricate processes and complex systems, and then to use this knowledge for the benefit of earth's inhabitants, animal, human, and plant. Here is the original commission authorizing man to use science and technology as basic activities on this earth. Science is man's controlled study and understanding of the makeup and function of the world. Technology is the putting of this knowledge to work for the development and use of the earth and its resources. This is for the good of all of earth's inhabitants. It includes such fields of human service as agriculture, engineering, medicine, chemistry, physics, mathematics, language, and communication. This also includes the study of how to serve God or how to perform religion, how to deal with man, sociology, and the rule of law, governments, and a host of other technologies too numerous to mention. This twofold commission, to subdue and have dominion, to conquer and rule, includes all productive human activities. These two concepts have been expressed in other words such as science and technology, research and development, theory and application, and study and practice. This command placed man as God's superior over the created world and all its contents. In Psalms 8, verses 3 through 8, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas." So the psalmist stated quite plainly here, like we learn here in Genesis, that man is put over the other animals upon this earth. The problem is, though, that man has failed in stewardship. As the writer of Hebrews says, commenting on this passage in Psalms, Hebrews 2 and 8, "But now we see not yet all things put under him." Man, instead of using the earth for good under God, he has denied God and abused his stewardship. This original commission has never been canceled. Man is still under its obligations. The scientific and technical activities still are included in God's instruction to man in things pertaining to the earth and its inhabitants. Man would find himself greatly more productive and effective in this type of activity if he would only approach them in the reverent and believing attitude of an honest and good servant of his Maker. After giving man this commission, God told him how he had provided for his most essential need, that of food. Man had work to do and would need a repeated renewal of energy to continue the work. This was to be provided through the marvelous digestive system, an internal energy conversion apparatus designed by God as a part of man's body as well as those of the animals. The energy supply was to be perpetually available through the fruits and herbs of the plant kingdom established by God on the third day of creation. The supply could not be exhausted, since these plants were designed to reproduce themselves by the bearing and yielding of seed. And as man spread out and filled the earth, his food would be available everywhere. God said these would be found upon the face of all the earth. There were originally no deserts or other uninhabitable regions. The animals, too, were to obtain their food from every green herb, a term possibly meaning all green plants, including grasses. The animals, in all probability, also had work to do under man's direction. But at this time, our present time, thousands of years after the flood, it is impossible to determine exactly the original nature and intended function of the different kinds of animals. After the flood, most animals developed a fear and a dread of man. Genesis 9:2 says, "And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, and upon all that moveth upon the earth, and upon all the fishes of the sea. Into your hands are they delivered." Now we see that today. The wild animals are certainly still just as wild as they can be. Whatever original function animals had under the direction of man was lost after the flood, and probably immediately after man's sin, when the world became a cursed world. It is clear from this passage that in the original world it was not intended that either man or animal should eat animal food. As far as man was concerned, this was changed at the time of the flood. Genesis 9:3 says, "Every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb, and I have given you all things." This will be discussed later in the study of Genesis when we cover that chapter. Whether some who lived before the flood dared to eat meat against God's will, we're not told. But this is a possibility. Jabal introduced cattle raising in Genesis 4:20. As far as meat-eating animals are concerned, their desire to eat meat must have developed later, either at the time of the curse or after the flood. Even today, such animals can and will, if they have to, live on a vegetarian diet. Whether such structures as fangs and claws were a part of the original equipment, or whether recessive features, which only became dominant due to selection processes later, or whether mutational features following the curse, or exactly what, we cannot be sure. The balance of nature would have been much different then than at present, when the balance is maintained by predators keeping in check the large numbers of lower animals that would take over. The scriptures do predict that in the future world of the church, there will once again be no struggle between animals or between man and animals. In Isaiah 11:6-9, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatten together, and a little child shall lead them. And a cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. And the suckling child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." This scripture describing the church age, the kingdom of heaven, when natural enemies, the Jew and the Gentile, would be able to dwell together peacefully in the church. But it also may be a glimpse of the new heaven and the new earth after the second coming of Christ. Now let us read the last verse of Genesis chapter 1 and the first four verses of Genesis chapter 2. "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, and the evening and the morning were the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God ended his work, which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day, and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. These are the generations of the heavens and of the earth when they were created." God had now completed his creation and his work. Before resting from his work, he inspected it all and pronounced the whole result to be very good. Six times before, he had seen that what he had made was good. But now that it was complete, with every part in perfect harmony with every other part, all perfectly formed, and with an abundance of inhabitants, he saw with great joy that it was all exceedingly good. The word "very" is properly translated as "exceedingly." It was all exceedingly good. Back in the 27th verse of this first chapter of Genesis, we are told, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. God uses the word created, not evolved. His word does not state that he allowed them to mutate from lower forms of life. No mention of God producing man from chimpanzees or gorillas. It simply and authoritatively tells us that he created them, male and female. We believe that Adam transcribed the very words of God in the first chapter. That is what God said he did, and he did exactly what he said. Many scientists refuse to believe the Genesis account for one simple reason. They can't believe it because they do not believe that God himself exists. And this one verse, verse 31 of chapter 1, where God saw that everything was very good, this verse is itself sufficient to refute any theory which tries to accommodate the geological age concept in the Genesis record of creation. Everything in the universe was at this time, in God's own perfect judgment, still exceedingly good. There could have been nothing that was not good at all in creation. No struggle for existence, no disease, no pollution, no physical calamities such as earthquakes, floods, etc., no imbalance or lack of harmony, no sickness, no disorder, no arguments, no quarrels, no violence, no sin, and most important, no death. Even Satan was still good at this point. His rebellion and fall must have come later. Fossils definitely speak of death, often violent and sudden death. They all speak of disease and injuries and of storms and convulsions. They actually speak of a world like our present world. Romans 8:22 says, "For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now." Yet death only entered into the world when sin came in through man. Romans 5:12 says, "By one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned." We must conclude then that since the whole creation was very good before man sinned, it is very obvious that the fossil record now found in the sedimentary rocks of the earth's crust could only have been formed sometime after man sinned. The fossils could not have been deposited either before the 6 days of creation, as in the gap theory, or during the 6 days of creation according to the D-age type theory. How could God have looked upon a world of struggle and conflict and looked into the rocks to see the remains of billions of dead animals as well as human-like creatures and then describe it all as being exceedingly good? Such a suggestion makes God to be a different God from the God of the Bible. Not the God of all grace who cares for every sparrow. Not the God of love and mercy which would make him too kind to create a world by such a process as suggested by the geological age theory. The God of perfect wisdom, therefore certainly able to devise a better way than that. The God of all power, certainly fully able to create by a better way. The God of infinite order, not author of confusion and wasteful inefficiency, which is implied if the fossil record is truly a record of pre-human earth history. The Bible tells us that this is not the way the earth was created. And as we shall see later, the earth-changing events of the great flood in the days of Noah are quite sufficient to account for all the events associated with the sedimentary rocks and the fossil record. At the time of man's creation, the whole universe was a beautiful, perfect creation, the finest that the mind of God himself could provide for man. And before we leave this last verse of Genesis, chapter 1, verse 31, we would like to again emphasize the accuracy of the Genesis account as contrasted with the theory of evolution. According to biblical chronology, as found especially in Genesis 5 and 11, Adam was created only a few thousand years ago and was definitely the first man. Acts 17:26, the NIV version says, "From one man he made every nation of men." 1 Corinthians 5:45 speaks of the first man, Adam. Matthew 19:4, Jesus speaking of Adam and Eve said, "He which made them at the beginning made them male and female." Adam was originally without sin and lived in a perfect environment, as we have just seen in this 31st verse. But we will see that he rebelled against God and brought God's curse on the world, Genesis chapter 3. Since that time, this whole creation has been groaning and travailing together in pain until now, Romans 8:22. The popular evolutionary history speculates that the common ancestor of apes and man developed about 10 million years ago, and that modern man appeared about 1 million years ago. Evolutionary anthropologists argue over the exact line of descent. It should be realized that there is no real fossil evidence of the great number of missing links in human evolution. There is also no pre-evidence of the hypothetical common ancestor from which man and the apes came originally. Some who do not believe in the evolution theory have studied population statistics. Their findings show that the Bible chronology is much more accurate and realistic than evolutionary chronology. And we would like to have more to say about that in detail in our next lesson. But it becomes quite plain as we study the Bible that those of us who believe God, believe in God, who believe the Bible, have an ability now to gain some understanding that the rest of the world cannot have about the creation of this universe. The Bible is plainly telling us the facts that we need to know, telling us enough so that we can intelligently have some kind of a realization about how it started, about the creation, about the purpose of things, and that gives us a greater purpose for our lives now and as we look to the future. We're above and beyond those who do not believe in God, those who want to theorize and imagine things and completely take God out of the realm of things here. We're above and beyond them in our understanding, in our faith, in our hope. So we conclude our lesson at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.